Good morning, and thanks for tuning in to 88.5 KRFY for Community Conversations. I'm Chris Bessler, today's host. Today we kick off our coverage of the contested races that will be on the ballot for the upcoming November 3rd election. We talk with candidates for District 1 Idaho Legislature for Senate and for House Seat A. Our talk is with the incumbents, Senator Jim Woodward and Representative Heather Scott. As you'll hear in just a moment, although on the ballot you will see they both have opponents, their opponents are not campaigning and turned down our invitation to participate. This is the first in our four-week series covering the contested local races that will be on the ballot. Next Thursday, October 1st, we cover the Bonner County Sheriff's race. On Thursday, October 8th, we interview candidates for Bonner County Commissioner District 1. And our final interview on October 15th is with the three candidates for State Representative Seat B. And with that, here's today's talk. We're speaking now with the candidates for two of the District 1 legislative positions that will be up for election this November 3rd, the Idaho Senate and the Idaho House Seat A. On the ballot, voters will see two candidates for Idaho Senate, Democrat Vera Gadman and incumbent Republican Jim Woodward. However, Ms. Gadman is not actively campaigning and has given us word that she won't participate. But we have with us today State Senator Woodward. Jim, thank you for participating.
Thank you, Chris.
Also on the ballot, voters will see two candidates for the District 1 Idaho House Seat A with Republican incumbent Heather Scott and her Democratic candidate opponent, Gail Bolin. However, Ms. Bolin is also not campaigning and not participating today, but Representative Scott, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having us on.
We would like to kick off with opening statements, basically an open mic for each of you to give us 2 or 3 or 4 minutes to introduce yourselves to the voters. And I'd like to say, aside from giving us some background on yourself, tell us why you wish to run again. And Heather, why don't we start with you?
Thank you, Chris. So as many of your listeners know, I've been the state rep for 6 years now. I've been on State Affairs Committee. I'm currently on State Affairs Committee, Environment, Energy, and Technology, and Judiciary and Rules Committee. And all those committees are very active. Actually, they were quite active in the special session that we'll probably get into later. But state affairs deals a lot with voting issues and anything that it affects the state in general. And then judiciary and rules, we do a lot about the prisons and penalties for crimes and stuff like that. And then environment, energy, and technology, it's transitioned a lot from environment over the last few years into technology. And as you know, technology changes so much these days, and it seems to be moving exponentially. That seems to be a really busy committee also. So I've been in Idaho for 22 years. I live over in Blanchard, have a little farm, and why am I rerunning is a question. I don't know. Every year you learn more and you think you can make a bigger difference because you know more. And I don't know how true that is or not. You learn to navigate the system better. You understand the process better. And that ultimately helps you to be able to help the citizens better. So that's some of the reasons I'm rerunning. And so I just look forward to representing the citizens and looking out for their best interest and trying to protect their liberties and freedoms, what's left.
Okay. Heather Scott, thank you for that opening statement. Same to you, Jim Woodward. Let us know a little bit about your background and tell us why you're running again.
Well, thank you, Chris. I'm Jim Woodward, currently serving as state senator for Legislative District 1, which is right now is all of Boundary County and most of Bonner County. We are coming up on that, finishing up the census, and then we'll be looking at redistricting again here shortly. I am Idahoan by upbringing, grew up in Sandpoint and Bonner's Ferry, engineer by education. I attended the University of Idaho, and a naval submarine officer by training. I have a total of 21 years of combined active and reserve service in the United States Navy. And finally, a small business owner by the School of Hard Knocks is what I like to say. I've learned a few lessons over the last decade or so. And now, currently, some might say I'm a politician, but I still prefer to, hopefully I can earn that title of public decision maker representing our two northernmost counties. My first term in the legislature, which I'm just finishing up, the terms run up through the end of November. And in my first term, I served on two different committees, the Senate Finance Committee, which meets with the House Appropriations Committee as the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee, or JFAC. And so we've spent a lot of time in the last couple of years learning about the state budget. And I say when you're looking at the checkbook, then you know what's going on in all parts of the process. I've also been serving on the Education Committee, where all policy for both K-12 education and our higher education system are set. We have four community colleges in the state, four universities, and then the entire K-12 system, which are just our K-12 system consists of about 315,000 students and, I think it's around 17,000 or so teachers throughout the state. So that's what I've been involved in my first term. My goal all along has been to work in the business of state government. I like to make sure that we're operating efficiently, and I think that people look to our system of self-governance here for stability, but then we make improvements where necessary as times change and maybe technology drives some things that we try to change. Why would I like to serve again as a state senator? I'm just getting started, and there is a learning curve, and so I think that I'm starting to have my feet wet for sure at this point, but I've said all along I'm taking my turn. I'm not looking for a career, but I think that it is appropriate to try and, if you jump into this business or in this piece of activity in the state, then we should go for some certain amount of time where you're the most productive. I think most people down there recognize that you learn in the beginning, you're productive at some point, and then later on you end up with enough political baggage that you're not effective anymore. So we'll try and figure out where that sweet spot is when it's time to step aside and let somebody else take their turn.
Okay. Well, Jim Woodward, thank you for that. Now let's go back to Heather Scott, our House seat A representative. Heather, what do you think are the most important issues in the race or that people should be cognizant of?
In the election?
Yes.
Okay.
As it pertains to the election, we'll come back and talk about what might come up in the next legislative term.
So I think when you're looking at a candidate, you want to find a candidate that will work with you on your issues, that will be honest and transparent, and that's actually looking out for the citizens' interest. And that may not mean always that they're going to vote exactly like you, but it means that they're going to protect your liberties, your freedoms. They're going to stay within their boundaries of government and their authority in government. And they're, I like to say a lot, they're not working for the Boise machine. As you know, Chris, a lot of decisions get made, they all get made in Boise, but a lot of the administrative staff is out of the Boise office. And it's definitely a different type of thinking down there. And so you want to make sure, I guess my goal is always to make sure that the citizens up here are represented when decisions are being made on how to spend money and where money goes across the state. Sometimes I notice that we get the unfair, we get a disadvantage because we are so far away. Our voice is sometimes silenced because you can't come in and testify January, February, March for every bill you may want to testify for. So I try to make sure that the voice of the people up here is definitely being shared and their concerns are being addressed.
Okay. Any other issues that you think are pertinent in this particular election cycle?
Well, you know, I think it's unfortunate that the Democrat opponents aren't on. We do need to have the conversations on where we differ. Of course, we're going to differ on social issues and some of the, you know, extreme issues. But there are places we can agree. And anytime, you know, you can have those conversations, you can have those debates, it's a good thing. Because what my concern is that citizens are always manipulated by the media to keep them fighting, to keep the Democrats fighting with the Republicans. And we're always being shown our differences on the TV or on the news. And we need to start focusing on some of the things we do have in common that maybe we both have concerns with. And I think some of those issues, if we could stop fighting over some of the small stuff by the parties, I really think there's some places we can make progress, because ultimately it's the citizens against government. It's not the Democrats against the Republicans, because we're all people. It's the people against the government, and how much control do we want to give to government over our everyday lives? And I'm guessing that Democrats and Republicans can agree that we don't need a nanny or we don't need a mom to run our everyday decisions in life. And I don't think many of us want government to do the same. So if we just can have those conversations, I think that'd be great.
All right, Heather, thank you for that. Senator Woodward, same question to you. What issues do you think are most important in this election cycle?
Thanks, Chris. So I think Heather, Representative Scott, said that well. When you're looking for a candidate, you're looking for someone to represent your interests. I also, in my manner, I try to provide what I think is important is a lot of stability and predictability in representing the district. And then the last piece, communication, making sure that people are able to get a hold of me and making sure that I'm putting out what I know and what I learned, because that's really what the system is, one of representation, where we go down and participate in a lot of conversations and have a lot of information available and spend our time to understand the issues that we're going to vote on. But then we need to be able to share that with folks back home so that they can understand how we came to a conclusion on a particular topic. When we're trying to answer the question of what's most important in this race, I do think that the coronavirus has really overshadowed most everything this year. We're talking a lot about property taxes last year, and I'm serving on an interim committee right now regarding property taxes, trying to look at what some answers might be. We have a property tax system that works well, I say, in a steady state condition, but the economy is never in a steady state condition. And so we've seen through the economic cycles of a boom in 2006 and 7 and 8, the property tax residential values were going up greatly, and we had a problem back then. During the down cycle in 2009, 10, 11, then the property taxes again don't track. And now we're back to a boom. And so the property tax burden, the amount of property tax that one category versus another takes shifts back and forth. The total property tax collection is set by taxing district budgets, but who pays a portion, or what portion, is determined by values. And so when the economy runs strong and we have lots of folks moving here and we have a real strong residential real estate market, then those values go up. The assessed values by law have to be in 90 to 110% of market value. And so the assessor tries to keep those values in line with the requirements of the law. And then more and more the burden is picked up by residential, and that's what we're seeing. And that's where we talk about folks getting taxed out of their homes. But the opposite can happen during a downturn. So any to close on that, just that we have a property tax system that doesn't track the economy very well, and we end up with conflict every time we're going up or down. And so we're working on that.
Okay. Jim, Heather brought up a point that our distance from Boise gives us less visibility or clout down there. What's your take on that?
Well, politics is people, but so establishing relationships with folks is important, and being able to have people trust and believe in you when the time comes that you need to have them, when you're asking them to vote a certain way, or when you need to provide a part of the conversation and make sure they really hear you. So that can still happen, but we can see we're the furthest away from Boise in the state. We're about 415 miles or so is what it takes me to get home. And so it's harder to attend some meetings. We travel more if we want to be there in person. It's more difficult to be a part of the conversation. There's the expression, if you're not at the table, you're on the table. And I think that's maybe what kind of happens sometimes. And if you're not down there and being and part of it, then it can be challenging. We've had people from up north be very successful in representing our interests down there. And maybe the interests are a little bit different, but I think in the end, we're all Idahoans also, and just have different geography and different economies, local economies that need different things. That's always the challenge in lawmaking, is to come up with something that works well across 1.7 million people and all the different conditions that are out there, all the local conditions and environments, that to try and come up with an answer that fits everybody is difficult.
Okay. Heather, Jim brought up something that will be on the plate these next 2 years, I'm sure, and that's redistricting. We're finishing up the U.S. Census, and that will the data that's gathered there will determine how the state gets, the legislative districts get apportioned here. And I assume that'll happen over the next 2 years. There will be redistricting. Do you have any take on that? Any concerns about how redistricting might take place?
I'm not very involved in that process. There's a committee that does that, and I'd love to say it's completely fair and honest, and that's just the way it works. But it's like Jim said, it's the people that are there that are making the decisions. I don't know that I would have much say in what that looks like. I can make some speculation on what's going to happen with our district, but ultimately, I don't know. I don't really have an answer for that.
Jim, how about you? What do you think about redistricting coming up? And for us, I think where it will impact us the most is that a chunk of Bonner County belongs to District 7, which is this huge district that runs from, just on the other side of the Long Bridge from Sandpoint all the way down to Riggins. And it doesn't provide the community members there with representation that really understands what's going on up around Sagal area. So, Jim, your take on what we might see out of redistricting.
You bet, Chris. So that redistricting committee is six people chosen. Each of the positions, the Speaker of the House and the Pro Tem of the Senate, both the leaders in the bodies, both get to appoint somebody. Then both the majority party leaders and then the minority party leaders, I think how that works. I must be off a little bit there, because you end up with three Democrats and three Republicans on the committee. And so it's difficult. Sometimes it's ended up in a lawsuit or going to court, I think the last time, to settle it. But regardless, there's a committee there set up equally, and we go through that process. And I think the population numbers from the last census, we had about 44,000 people per legislative district. And with our population, the amount we've increased now, we'll have to have about 50,000 people per district of the 35 legislative districts. And so that means take the total population, divide by 35, and you should come up with 50,000 is what And so then you have to go out and draw those lines with guidelines that say, keep communities together, try not to break these areas apart or county lines and the other guidelines they have. And so we know that that wasn't great last time because we ended up with Bottle Bay, Garfield, Glengarry, all of those areas are in a different district and they're really part of the Sandpoint community. We hope, like you said, to get those people back into District 1. But where the lines end up, it can be challenging. And sometimes you end up moving lines that lines move. In the past, we had Senator Keough and Senator Joyce Broadsword, and they ended up in the same district when the line was redrawn. And so then we ended up, I think that Senator Broadsword at that time stepped aside, and then Senator Keough stayed in office. So, because they were both in the same district. So that's the kind of thing that can happen. The other piece on redistricting is at the federal level, there is a little bit of talk about that we might end up with three congressional representatives instead of the two. Right now we have two senators, as every state does, and we have two representatives, but our population might be growing, might be at the point that we end up with three representatives in the U.S. Congress.
Yeah.
So right now we have Representative Mike Simpson, Representative Russ Fulcher, and Congressman Fulcher represents us here in this area, but there's a potential for, and the state is divided up essentially with a north-south line where eastern Idaho and is Representative Simpson, and then western Idaho clear up to the north is all Representative Fulcher, but there's potential to make, it would be three districts.
Yeah, that'd be quite a sea change for Idaho. So,
yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about COVID-related issues that might come up before the legislature in this next term. Heather, what do you see the role of the legislature in determining state policy concerning the coronavirus restrictions? We do have the governor, he's the executive of the state, and he's been basically setting forth the policies and enforcing them that we have up to this point. What would you like to see come out of the legislature concerning COVID-19 issues in this next term?
So I think I'd like to see more teamwork when it comes to emergencies. And our Constitution and our law was really unclear on how to address some of this. And that's why we're seeing what we're seeing happening in our state with the executive branch making almost every single decision, actually every decision out there, with no oversight from the legislature, with no input from the legislature. We see the continuance of this emergency, And I've come publicly and said it's like tyranny. We're seeing tyranny where one person is making the decisions in the state. Now they've set up their own committee of cronies to determine where the money goes. But ultimately, that's not how government's supposed to work. There's been over 75 laws that he has literally changed with a stroke of a pen. So I really think with addressing this COVID or any emergency, we need to get back from, we need to do more with the control and the powers of each branch and what that looks like in any emergency. And then how long they can be extended, because right now it's been extended for months and months and months, and it looks like it's going to be continued until we get back to session to put an end to it. So I think we really have to look at the authority that's been given over time to the executive branch. I definitely see that our legislature, it literally is, I think the best word is impotent. It really has no, it's really just not involved in any of the decision making right now, and it's been really discouraging. So hopefully that will be addressed, and And I think what I'd like to see too, and I don't know if we'll get to it, but a lot of this regional government and regional decision making, we need more transparency. I think we need oversight by the legislature. And so we really need to clean up the law, clean up possibly the Constitution, and address some of those concerns that we've seen statewide.
Heather, do you think that's likely that the would that start with a committee, I presume, would have to say, hey, we want to make these kinds of changes. A change to the Constitution is a pretty big deal, which would, I assume, take probably some years to accomplish.
It's not really that big of a deal if it's only like a 2/3 vote from the House and Senate. And actually, we passed a constitutional amendment this year that will be on the ballot. Someone just reminded me it's on the ballot right now. I think it's it's Joint Resolution 4, and it does something with, and I have to look it up maybe by the end of the call, but it does something to address the how many districts we can have, a maximum amount of districts in the state. So it really is just like any other bill. It just passes the House and Senate, and then it has to go on the ballot for the people to agree or not agree. And I can't imagine most citizens would not agree that they want to be represented by all parts of government, not just by one person in government. So I don't know that it would be that hard to fix. Where you run into the trouble is that many legislators who are supposed to be working for the citizens and not the governor are fearful of making decisions that might offend the governor, or maybe put him back in line, because then they're afraid their bills might get vetoed. So there's that. I don't know. We'll see. The House actually was moving in that direction in the special session and didn't quite get the Senate on board. But I do think it needs to be done. And I do think it probably will be addressed this year. I think that was, being as a Senate would not end the emergency, they did put some strong language in a resolution that's the way they're moving to fixing it legislatively.
So I surmise from your position here that you're not happy with the way the governor handled the coronavirus situation. How would you have liked to seen it handled?
Yes, so I was not happy with the way he handled it. And any emergency, in any emergency, when you're getting 30% of your budget from the federal government money, there needs to be oversight. I don't think it's appropriate that the governor has been outside of his boundaries with his authority to actually change law and write law. That's a lawsuit. Whether you'll get the legislators to pursue that, I don't know. It's I would argue it's almost an impeachable offense if we allow anybody in government to act outside the boundaries we have set for them. That's a huge problem. So yes, I'm very concerned with the way that this has been handled. The legislature has not been involved in the decision making. There has been a weekly conference call for the House members and the Senate members. And so the governor gets on there and he gives a report on what's happening with the health and welfare, what's happening with the emergency department. And, he spits off some numbers and talks about the programs. And then he asks if there's any questions. Now that's not how your representation government is supposed to be working. That's no different than a king or a queen in a country running as a dictatorship. So I have many concerns with his behavior throughout this emergency, and I think I'm not the only one. So.
Okay, well, Jim, I'm passing the same question on to you. First of all, how do you see the COVID-related issues coming before the legislature? But let's start out with, what do you think about the way the, the governor has handled the coronavirus response for the state?
Well, Chris, I think overall, I'm pleased, and so I answer that, and I have a little bit different take on it, but I'll tell you a quick little story. When I first joined the United States Navy, when any branch of the military you join, you show up and you get your head shaved and you get put in some PT gear and they start working you every day and they beat you down a little bit. You go to chow, you go to PT, you go to class, you go back to PT, you go to chow and so on. And they carry that on for a few days. And then after you've been there a little bit, they grab one of you and put you in charge for the day. And when that happens, you see that first person gets put in charge. You wonder, what the heck? This is one of us. Why is this person acting like this? And then the next day they put somebody else in charge. You think, man, all of these people are rotten. About 5 days later, when it's your turn, you get put in charge, then you have to make some decisions. And maybe not everybody's happy, but you have the information to make those decisions. So that was my first experience with leadership, is that we have a system in place and we put people in, and we select people to be our leaders. And then when we have done that, we need to make sure that we provide them with the backing and the trust that they're making the best decisions. We may not agree with their decisions, but we have another election cycle if we truly don't like their decisions. But at the same time, maybe they have more information, just like I was talking about earlier, that as legislators, we have a lot of conversations and read a lot of material. So it's our job to do that and to make a decision. And it's the governor's job to make a decision. Could I sit now and in hindsight, critique some of the actions? Probably. The unemployment system did not respond in the way it should have. We left a lot of people after mandating paying into a system for a long, long time. We left a lot of folks out for a while as we tried to file that many claims. That was unprecedented turn in the system from a tiny number of monthly claims up to record levels we'd never seen. Maybe have we gone on too long with the emergency order? I don't know what the right answer is there. It'll probably take a lot more time before we all know, can look back and say what the right answer is. But I certainly trust in the abilities of Governor Little to think and to take input. But there is a list of some things that the Senate put out in a resolution. And so those are things that, situations brought to light by a unique time. We have coronavirus. The last time we really had a pandemic, which is 1918, the Spanish flu, I think it was 1918. And so it's been a long time since we've looked at some of our emergency, the laws surrounding an emergency situation. Most of those stem in Title 46, and we'll be back into that and look and be deciding, should the legislature be able to call itself into session or not? And maybe it's appropriate in some situations. Right now, it's not the case. Right now, the governor can call a special session for some topics, and so maybe we want to have that. But the other side of that argument is that, do we have a legislature that calls itself back in all the time and end up with a full-time legislature? And I think some of the beauty of the legislative system we have in Idaho is that we're citizen legislators. And when we write a law, we know that if we're in that legislative session for 3 months, there are 9 months outside of that that we're going to live under that law. So we're not above the law. We always know that that's going to affect our life too, whatever that vote is. So I think we have a system now that serves us well, but maybe there is a time when the legislature should be calling itself in. We'll talk about it this coming session. Another one that came up on that list is what's called non-cognizable funds. The legislature sets the budget every year, if money comes in outside of the normal process, if a grant is awarded or the CARES Act is passed and money is made available from the federal government, then how does that money, how do we authorize spending that money? We have a board of examiners, three people, the governor and two others, I think the controller, and I can't remember who else is on the board of examiners. But we have a process in place to authorize the spending of money that's coming in, for example, in an emergency. If you look back historically, the most we've ever had in non-cognizable funds, that's funds that have been spent outside the normal legislative process, is about $200 million, and that's a big year. Normally, it's in the tens of millions. But this year, the amount is $1.25 billion, so six times at least of what we've done in the highest year ever, and many times higher than what we would normally do. So we'll go and talk about non-cognizable funds and whether there should be a limit to how much can be spent through the non-cognizable fund authorization process. And there are a couple others on the list there, but going back to the legislature and the governor and what the rules are there, I take a look at us as a policy setting body. And if the policies are in place, then the operations department can take care of what's going on. And then you can come back and review. If you don't like what the operations department did, you can come back and review it. And when there's an emergency going on, the police chief is acting. You don't expect city council to meet to talk, to advise the police chief. And so I think that if we have the laws in place and the constitution in place, then we should be able to operate with the executive branch running the business of the day, tactical versus strategic, I guess is what I'm saying. The legislature should be providing that long-term strategic policy. And if we have some areas we need to go back, that's what I'm getting at. If we're going to go back and review, then let's do that, recognizing, though, that the goal is that we can set in place policy that works for the executive branch to carry out and for them to carry out in the manner that we desire that.
Okay. I'm going to throw in a little station ID here for folks that may have just tuned in. This is 88.5 KRFY, and we're speaking today with candidates for two of the District 1 legislative positions that are up for election on November 3rd, the Idaho Senate and the Idaho House Seat A. We're talking with incumbent Senator Jim Woodward and incumbent Representative Heather Scott. Although you will see Democratic opponents for each on the ballot, those candidates are not campaigning and they declined to participate today. So I just want to make this point that our speakers today are in different races. They're not opposing each other.
We actually get along real well, Chris.
Well, that's great. I mean, it's great to have a diversity of opinion. And Heather, as you brought up, it's too bad that the Democrats aren't having active candidates, because it's important to examine questions and hear all sides, and that's what that brings to the table.
Well, I agree, and I'm, you know, we Senator Woodward and I completely disagree on this issue, and I can't let that go without saying a little bit more than that last.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, so we are separate and equal branches of government. And we are not to be run. I think a lot of people forget that government is set up to fight with itself. When the executive branch, there's tension between the executive branch and the legislative branch, that's good for the people because that gives us more liberty and freedoms. Because the government's, when the government's busy with each other trying to work things out. So when you start looking at another equal branch of government and submitting to it, and that's what I take from Senator Woodward's comments, we're not opposing each other, we're on different tickets, but we do not work for the executive branch. And when it's not okay that we as a legislature cannot violate the Constitution, why are we allowing the executive branch to violate the Constitution? The other thing is, we are not the military and we are not a business. In a business or the military, it is designed for top-down control. That's how it's supposed to work to keep a business running properly, or the military, it's completely top-down. In government, it is bottom-up citizens' representation, equal branches, no branch over another. And by allowing a governor to overstep his boundaries and to violate the Constitution, and that's just absurd to me. And the people lose in those kind of situations every time. And so the way an emergency has been set up is 30 days and maybe extend it for another 30 days, but it is never intended for this rolling emergency for 6 or 8 months of complete tyranny and control of all the decision-making, all the policy decision. And when you get 30% of your budget coming in from the federal government, there's a lot of policy, there's a lot of crony capitalism going on, and there's no checks and balances in what this governor's done. Sorry, I just had to add that.
Okay, Jim, you can. We'll let you add
I'm
some more.
I'm passionate about that.
Jim, I do, Chris. Yeah, I appreciate Representative Scott's comments there. I mean, I do completely agree that separate branches of government. Maybe I didn't quite express myself what I was trying to say, but separate and equal branches of government. I don't think that we want one branch to overpower the others. But I was making the point that I think that you still have an executive branch that's supposed to take care of day-to-day type activities, running the agencies and so on. Representative Scott has a really good point about the time frame too, because how long does an emergency go on? And so that's that question about should the legislature come back into session if we're not pleased with some of what's going on? Hopefully I haven't left the wrong impression with my seatmate there.
Okay. Oh, you're just a senator.
I have just one more question that's kind of along these lines before we get on to a couple other issues I'd like to cover. And one is that I'd like to get your individual takes, start with you, Heather, on the special session that occurred in late August that the governor did call into session, because there was a group of folks that was upset, I think mainly about the governor's handling of the coronavirus, that pushed into the hearing a really boisterous activity. They even broke a glass door. From our distance up here, it looked like there was a breakdown in our civil processes. But Representative Scott, what was your take on that whole incident?
So I think that the media loves to ramp it up and make it look awful. But I didn't see that as the overarching issue that was going on down there. There were two incidents. One was the very first day of session when, for some reason, the Speaker of the House, who controls the gallery, decided that only a certain amount of people would be allowed in the gallery. And so when that happened, people were expecting to get into the gallery, and they start shutting the doors on them. And so there was some struggle between officers and people on both sides. And I don't know that it was the people that broke the glass or the police officers that broke the glass. I think it was the pressing from both sides that broke the glass, which is really unfortunate. And I think the bigger question that should have come out of that is, why are we locking people out of the gallery? So that was, I don't know how that was spun in the papers. I don't read the newspapers, but that was the first thing. And then the second incident, which was in one of my committees, was, we had a regular session with, there was a lot of issues with, let's just say the chairman for one of the committees on the House side is pretty new. And he was allowing things and not allowing things. He was not following the process. And I think citizens were confused and frustrated. And at one day he allowed people to sit in a certain area, and the next day he disallowed it. And it's almost like it was, I don't want to say it was a setup, but the second he asked them to move from the area the second day, he had police officers out in the hallway lined up to come in almost immediately. So I think there's a little bit going on there behind the scenes. I don't know what exactly the media reported on that, but it was unfortunate that that became the overtone of what maybe got back to North Idaho. That was not the majority of what happened down there, but that was the public part of what happened down there. And so that's just really unfortunate that that's what came out of it up here.
Jim, can you speak to this, your take on the special session and that whole kind of struggle that evolved there up in trying to get into the galleries?
Sure. I did not witness any of that. I was in the building, but we were in some other meetings and we're on the other end of the building. So what I got out of the was I was watching media accounts the same as anybody, just that I was closer then. But what I think did come out of the special session is that one of the two proposed pieces of legislation on election law, so we helped out set up something that would work better for the county clerks. We know that absentee ballots are being used at a much higher rate than they have in the past. And so the county clerks can now, when they receive those absentee ballots, they can get those out of the envelope and get them ready to be tabulated. But they can't tabulate until the day of election, but they can prepare all of that so that we can get election results the day of election like we're used to. And so that was one important piece with county clerks. The other one was about electronic poll books, and there came a question came up, and so it just didn't make it through the process. But then the other piece, big goal of the legislative special session was the civil liability bill, and there were numerous attempts at that, and a bill did come through in the end that. Got through this the sausage making process, I guess, and so just to provide some assurity, hopefully to businesses and schools and so on, that it, as in regards to liability, legal liability, if someone were to come into your business and then say later that they got the coronavirus from you or at your business, your place of business, is there a legal liability for that? And I think that effort was in response to some lawsuits that were starting around the country. So hopefully we can avoid some lawsuits that might really be unfair to people that when they're not really controlling the spread of the coronavirus. So those were the two pieces that came out of it. Yeah, there was some contention for sure in the building, but we all got through it.
Okay. Heather, do you have another note on this?
Yeah, I just want to touch on the immunity bill because I was in. So what the process did was they set up these interim working committees about a month before session started, and we were given a base bill with exact language that they wanted passed. And the language in the working group, we were not allowed to change the language. That this is that same committee chairman. He was doing someone's bidding, which we can get into later. But so we had language that basically was going to give the government immunity, and it was going to make businesses literally be the enforcers of any government rule or mandate or order. And it was very not specific on who. It said if you made a good faith effort to it didn't say edict, but it said like an order. So I think it was ultimately at the very end of this, and it was a very long process, I think people caught on really quick that the government wanted immunity. And I don't know if you're aware, Chris, but our county is currently suing the governor for misappropriation of funds. And I had some concerns that this bill would give him immunity for what's going on. You know, I think what he's done is illegal, but that's to be challenged in the courts. So anyway, there were a lot of different steps. And I think the other thing I learned out of this is many of the hospitals did not treat people during this time of COVID, the scare that they wanted open hospital beds. So there were a lot of elective surgeries and maybe mandatory surgeries that the hospitals were neglecting citizens. And the original bills would have given immunity to these types of things. And so I guess the overall win is all of that got gutted from that bill. So there was no forcing smaller businesses or any business to be an enforcer of government. The hospitals will not get immunity for not treating folks, and the government will not get immunity. So those are three wins. And ultimately, the immunity bill we passed was pretty much, it didn't do much of anything. I think it just gave cover for the big lobby group that, oh, we got something passed. But ultimately, I think they lost what they wanted, which would have been really not good for citizens. So
okay.
That was a win.
Jim, you do get a chance to make a few more comments on this, although I want to push on to a couple other issues.
Well, I think Representative Scott had a lot clearer picture of that because she's on state affairs and saw the election law bills, and then she's on June rules, so she saw all that, and that was all happening in the House. I was voting on the floor, but not in either of those committees, so I think she has a pretty clear picture on it.
Okay, good. All right, well, we are going to run out of time before too much longer here, but let's talk about education. It's going to be impacted. The budget there, I'm sure, is going to be impacted by kind of the uncertain time we're in with the coronavirus and what our tax collections will be and so on. And the governor's already said that he was going to cut it back, but then he sounded like he's restored a good chunk of funding there. Let's start off with you, Jim, since you're, I think, on one of the committees that's involved there. What do you see coming on education, as particularly as it relates to the budget?
Okay. So at the beginning of the year, it looked like, with the onset of the coronavirus, it looked like there would be a financial challenge this year. And so the governor did hold back 5% on all agencies. Some of the money from the CARES Act, that's where the money was, we were able to put the money back in to the education budget. So that was right around $100 million that for a while we thought was going to be absent this year and is now going back. The picture next year, though, is still unpredictable. Maybe unpredictable is too strong, but there's question about where are state revenues next year. We know the revenues are actually above targets, above predictions this year, but we don't know for sure what will happen next year. There are still nationwide or statewide different trends going on than what we see here. Our economy, at the standpoint, I think, is stronger than ever. We had a lot of folks from out of town here this year. So locally, we're doing well, but the statewide revenue picture may not be the same by the end of next year. That's a little bit on the finance. And then education, so Chris, your question is where does education go here? And I guess the biggest question I see for the K-12 education system is what is the funding level? We fund based on attendance, and if there aren't people in schools, then that funding is going to go down. And so I think the biggest challenge here is how do you when you have a system in place, you have a lot of folks who you employees, and teachers and other staff. If you have to give up those staff when the students come back later, when we get through this, then are you able to get those people back? And so there's some question about what do you do to try and keep that education system intact? Because I would certainly think that people will go back to the public education system when they can and when they feel comfortable.
Okay. Heather, can you speak to education issues you see coming up before the legislature this next session?
You know, I try to steer clear of education for the most part. I have a different philosophy. I believe parents should be raising their kids. I truly believe I would get my kids out of government-run schools. With the data collection, the data sharing, some of the indoctrination on kids, and I think our, in order to regain confidence in public schools, we need an overhaul of the schools. And until parents actually stand up against what's happening in our schools, we're going to end up look at our society right now. I mean, we have kids getting out of public schools that don't know if they're a boy or a girl. I just saw the arrest records from Antifa over in Oregon, and most of the people arrested were teachers. Now, we've got some great teachers, and I get it, but I think those teachers need to be looking for different ways that they can be educating kids and unplugging from the government-run system to make our schools great, to make our schools where it's a safe learning environment, where parents are not afraid to send their kids to schools. So I know that's a different take, but that's kind of where I am on schools.
Okay. Thanks. All right. Well, I'm going to squeeze in one more question, then we're going to have to wrap it up. And basically, I just wanted to get back to, and I'll go to you first on this one, Heather, too. Transportation, you know, maintenance of our highways is always an issue, and allocation of funds across the state to address areas that really need help with their roads. What do you see in the next legislature concerning highway bills or just transportation?
I'm not in that committee, so don't follow it. I've been going to the regional meetings with the county. Ultimately, what I would like to see is out of our main budget of our tax collection that roads are paid for out of there. And if that means taking from health and welfare and public schools, I'm good with it. So I think that pie needs to be distributed a little differently, because I think roads are critical. It's a duty of government. It's a role of government we should do and provide. And so I think that should come from our general budget. And I think we're transitioning that way slowly, but as you know, government runs slow. So I have nothing else to add to that.
Okay. Jim, just a minute. Can you address that question as well? What do you see for transportation issues?
Yes, well, I hope to serve on the Transportation Committee this next session. If I'm successful in the election, then I'll hopefully be on JFAC, Education and Transportation. And it comes down to making sure that people understand where the needs are. We have a transportation board that really works at some of those decisions to, you know, how the money is distributed. Have a local member here, Jim Thompson, is our ITD board member for the district. He lives right here in Sandpoint. And I think what we need to work on, though, is making sure that we have this enough adequate funding, and then we need to be taking care of these projects. Everybody knows Lakeshore at the south end of the Long Bridge, the Lakeshore down through Sable, the challenges in that corridor, MacArthur up north of Bonner's Ferry, that one's been pushed back repeatedly. And so that I hope to emphasize and make some progress on getting some of that funding into these areas to deal with the congestion and the safety issues that we're seeing.
Well, Senator Jim Woodward, Representative Heather Scott, great talk today. Thanks so much for being here with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Chris.
That's a wrap for our show today. This is Community Conversations on 88.5 KRFY, and I'm Chris Bessler. Tune in each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. for more Community Conversations. Thank you for listening today.